when your womb quickens again, and you bear a living child. Then he will return, and not before."
Danny gestured at Ser Jorah and the others. "Leave us. I would speak with this Magi alone." Mormont and the Dothraki withdrew. "You knew," Danny said when they were gone. She ached inside and out, but her fury gave her strength. "You knew what I was buying, and you knew the price, and yet you let me pay it."
"It was wrong of them to burn my temple," the heavy, flat-nosed woman said pleasantly. "That angered the great shepherd."
"This was no God's work," Danny said coldly. "If I look back, I am lost. You cheated me. You murdered my child within me."
"The stallion who mounts the world will burn no cities now. His Khalasar shall trample no nations into dust."
"I spoke for you," she said, anguished. "I saved you."
"Save me?"
the Lazarine woman spat.
"Three riders had taken me, not as a man takes a woman, but from behind as a dog takes a bitch. The fourth was in me when you rode past. How then did you save me? I saw my God's house burn. What I had healed, good men beyond counting. My home they burned as well. And in the street I saw piles of heads. I saw the head of a baker who made my bread. I saw the head of a boy I had saved from dead-eye fever only 3 moons past. I heard children crying as the riders drove them off with their whips. Tell me again what you saved."
"Your life." Miri Maz Dua laughed cruelly.
"Look to your Carl and see what life is worth when all the rest is gone."
Danny called out for the men of her cars and bid them take Miri Maz Dua and bind her hand and foot. But the Magi smiled at her as they carried her off, as if they shared a secret. A word, and Danny could have her head off. Yet then what would she have? A head? If life was worthless, what was death? They led Khal Drogo back to her tent, and Danny commanded them to fill a tub, and this time there was no blood in the water. She bathed him herself, washing the dirt and the dust from his arms and chest, cleaning his face with a soft cloth, soaping his long black hair, and combing the knots and tangles from it until it shone again, as she remembered. It was well past dark before she was done, and Danny was exhausted. She stopped for drink and food, but it was all she could do to nibble at a fig and keep down a mouthful of water. Sleep would have been a release, but she had slept enough, too long, in truth. She owed this night to Drogo, for all the nights that had been, and yet might be. The memory of their first ride was with her, when she led him out into the darkness. For the Dothraki believed that all things of importance in a man's life must be done beneath the open sky. She told herself that there were powers stronger than hatred, and spells older and truer than any the Magi had learned in Ashai. The night was black and moonless, but overhead a million stars burned bright. She took that for an omen. No soft blanket of grass welcomed them here, only the hard, dusty ground, bare and strewn with stones. No trees stirred in the wind, and there was no stream to soothe her fears with the gentle music of water. Danny told herself that the stars would be enough. "Remember, Drogo," she whispered. "Remember our first ride together, the day we wed? Remember the night we made Rego, with the Khalasar all around us and your eyes on my face? Remember how cool and clean the water was in the womb of the world? Remember my sun and stars? Remember and come back to me." The birth had left her too raw and torn to take him inside of her. as she would have wanted. But Doria had taught her other ways. Danny used her hands, her mouth, her breasts. She raked him with her nails, and covered him with kisses, and whispered, and prayed, and told him stories. And by the end, she had bathed him with her tears. Yet Drogo did not feel, or speak, or rise. And when the bleak dawn broke over an empty horizon, Danny knew he was truly lost to her. When the sun rises in the west and sets in the east, she said sadly, when the seas go dry and mountains blow in the wind like leaves, when my womb quickens again and I bear a living child, then you will return, my sun and stars, and not before. Never, the darkness cried, never, never, never. Inside the tent, Danny found a cushion, soft silk stuffed with feathers. She clutched it to her breasts as she walked back out to Drogo, to her sun and stars. If I look back, I am lost. It hurt even to walk, and she wanted to sleep. To sleep, and not to dream. She knelt, kissed Drogo on the lips, and pressed the cushion down across his face. Tyrion.
They of my son, Tywin Lannister said. They do, my lord.
The messenger's voice was dulled by exhaustion. On the breast of his torn surcoat, the brindled boar of Crakehall was half obscured by dried blood. One of your sons, Tyrion thought. He took a sip of wine and said not a word, thinking of Jaime. When he lifted his arm, pain shot through his elbow, reminding him of his own brief taste of battle. He loved his brother, but he would not have wanted to be with him in the Whispering Wood for all the gold in Castle Rock. His lord father's assembled captains and bannermen had fallen very quiet as the courier told his tale. The only sound was the crackle and hiss of the log burning in the hearth at the end of the long, draughty common room. After the hardships of the long, relentless drive south, the prospect of even a single night in an inn had cheered Tyrion mightily, though he rather wished it had not been this inn again, with all its memories. His father had set a grueling pace, and it had taken its toll. Men wounded in the battle kept up as best they could, or were abandoned to fend for themselves. Every morning they left a few more by the roadside, men who went to sleep, never to wake. Every afternoon a few more collapsed along the way, and every evening a few more deserted, stealing off into the dusk. Tyrion had been half tempted to go with them. He had been upstairs enjoying the comforts of a feather bed and the warmth of Shay's body beside him, when his squire had woken him to say that a rider had arrived with dire news of River Run. So it had all been for nothing. The rush south, the endless forced marches, the bodies left beside the road, all for naught. Robb Stark had reached River Run days and days ago.
How could this happen?
Sir Harry Swift moaned.
How? Even after the Whispering Wood you had River Run ringed in iron, surrounded by a great host? What madness made Sir Jaime decide to split his men into three separate camps? Surely he knew how vulnerable that would leave them.
Better than you, you chinless craven,
Tyrion thought. Jaime might have lost River Run, but it angered him to hear his brother slandered by the likes of Swift, a shameless lickspittle, whose greatest accomplishment was marrying his equally chinless daughter to Sir Kevin, and thereby attaching himself to the Lannisters.
I would have done the same, his uncle responded, a good deal more calmly than Tyrion might have. You have never seen a river run, Sardis, or you would know that Jaime had little choice in the matter. The castle is situated at the end of the point of land where the Tumblestone flows into the Red Fork of the Trident. The rivers form two sides of a triangle, and when danger threatens, the Tullys open their sluice gates upstream to create a wide moat on the third side, turning a river run into an island. The walls rise sheer from the water, and from the towers the defenders have a commanding view of the opposite shores for many leagues around. To cut off all the approaches, a besieger must need place one camp north of the Tumblestone, one south of the Red Fork, and a third between the rivers west of the moat. There is no other way. None.
Sir Kevin speaks truly, my lords, the courier said. We'd built palisades of sharpened stakes around the camps, yet it was not enough, not with no warning, and the rivers cutting us off from each other. They came down on the north camp first. No one was expecting an attack. Mark Piper had been raiding our supply trains, but he had no more than 50 men. Sir Jamie had gone out to deal with them the night before. Well, with what he thought was them. We were told the Stark host was east of the Green Fork, marching south.
And your outriders?
Sir Gregor Clegane's face might have been hewn from rock. The fire in the hearth gave a somber orange cast to his skin and put deep shadows in the hollows of his eyes. They saw nothing. They gave you no warning. The blood-stained messenger shook his head. Our outriders had been vanishing. Mark Piper's work, we thought. The ones who did come back had seen nothing.
A man who sees nothing has no use for his eyes, the mountain declared. Cut them out and give them to your next outrider. Tell him you hope that four eyes might see better than two, and if not, the man after him will have six.
Lord Tywin Lannister turned his face to study Sir Gregor. Tyrion saw a glimmer of gold as the light shone off his father's pupils, but he could not have said whether the look was one of approval or disgust. Lord Tywin was oft quiet in council, preferring to listen before he spoke, a habit Tyrion himself tried to emulate. Yet this silence was uncharacteristic even for him, and his wine was untouched.
"You say they came at night," Sir Kevin prompted.
The man gave a weary nod. "The Blackfish led the van, cutting down our sentries and clearing away the palisades for the main assault. By the time our men knew what was happening, riders were pouring over the ditch banks and galloping through the camp with swords and torches in hand. I was sleeping in the west camp between the rivers. When we heard the fighting and saw the tents being fired, Lord Brax led us to the rafts, and we tried to pole across. But the current pushed us downstream, and the Tullys started flinging rocks at us with the catapults on their walls. I saw one raft smashed to kindling, and three others overturned, men swept into the river and drowned. And those who did make it across found the Starks waiting for them on the river bank.
Sir Flemont Brax wore a silver and purple tabard, and the look of a man who cannot comprehend what he has just heard.
My lord father.
Sorry, my lord, the messenger said. Lord Brax was clad in plate and mail when his raft overturned. He was very gallant.
He was a fool, Tyrion thought, swirling his cup and staring down into the winy depths. Crossing a river at night on a crude raft, wearing armor, with an enemy waiting on the other side? If that was gallantry, he would take cowardice every time. He wondered if Lord Brax had felt especially gallant, as the weight of his steel pulled him under the black water.
The camp between the rivers was overrun as well, the messenger was saying. While we were trying to cross, more Starks swept in from the west, two columns of armoured horse. I saw Lord Umber's giant in chains and the Malister Eagle, but it was the boy who led them, with a monstrous wolf running at his side. I wasn't there to see it, but it said the beast killed four men and ripped apart a dozen horses. Our spearmen formed up a shield wall and held against their first charge, but when the Tullys saw them engaged, they opened the gates of River Run and Tartius Blackwood led a sortie across the drawbridge and took them in the rear. God save us, Lord Lefford swore. Great John Umber fired the siege towers we were building, and Lord Blackwood found Sir Edmure Tully in chains, among the other captives, and made off with them all. Our south camp was under the command of Sir Fawley Prester. He retreated in good order when he saw that the other camps were lost, with 2,000 spears and as many bowmen. But the Tyrushy sellsword, who led his free riders, struck his banners and went over to the foe.
"Curse the man!" His Uncle Kevin sounded more angry than surprised. "I warned Jamie not to trust that one. A man who fights for coin is loyal only to his purse." Lord Tywin wove his fingers together under his chin. Only his eyes moved as he listened. His bristling, golden side whiskers framed a face so still it might have been a mask. But Tyrion could see tiny beads of sweat dappling his father's shaven head.
"How could it happen?" Sir Harry Swift wailed again. "Sir Jamie taken, a siege broken. This is a catastrophe."
Sir Adam Marbrand said,
"I'm sure we're all grateful to you for pointing out the obvious, Sir Harry. The question is, what should we do about it?"
"Oh, what can we do? Jamie's host is all slaughtered, all taken, all put to flight, and the Starks and the Tullys sit squarely across our line of supply. We are cut off from the west. They can march on Castle Rock if they so choose, and what's to stop them? My lords, we are beaten. We must sue for peace."
"Peace?" Tyrion swirled his wine thoughtfully, took a deep draught, and hurled his empty cup to the floor, where it shattered into 1,000 pieces.
"There's your peace, Sir Arius. My sweet nephew broke it for good and all when he decided to ornament the Red Keep with Lord Eddard's head. You'll have an easier time drinking wine from that cup than you will convincing Robb Stark to make peace now. He's winning. Or hadn't you noticed?"
"Two battles do not make a war," Sir Adam insisted. "We are far from lost. I should welcome the chance to try my own steel against this dark boy."
"Perhaps they would consent to a truce, and allow us to trade our prisoners for theirs," offered Lord Lefford. "Unless they trade 3-for-1, we still come out light on those scales," Tyrion said acidly. "And what are we to offer for my brother? Lord Eddard's rotting head?" "I had heard that Queen Cersei has the Hand's Daughters," Lefford said hopefully. "If we give the lad his sisters back."
Sir Adam snorted disdainfully.
"He would have to be an utter ass to trade Jaime Lannister's life for 2 girls.
"Then we must ransom Sir Jaime, whatever it costs," Lord Lefford said.
Tyrion rolled his eyes.
"If the Starks feel the need for gold, they can melt down Jaime's armor."
"If we ask for truce, they will think us weak," Sir Adam argued. "We should march on them at once."
Surely our friends at court could be prevailed upon to join us with fresh troops," said Sir Harry's. "And someone might return to Castle Rock to raise a new host."
Lord Tywin Lannister rose to his feet.
"They have my son,"
he said once more, in a voice that cut through the babble like a sword through suet.
"Leave me, all of you."
Ever the soul of obedience, Tyrion rose to depart with the rest. But his father gave him a look.
"Not you, Tyrion, remain. And you as well, Kevin. The rest of you, out."
Tyrion eased himself back onto the bench, startled into speechlessness. Sir Kevin crossed the room to the wine casks.
"Uncle," Tyrion called, "if you would be so kind."
"Here." His father offered him his cup, the wine untouched. Now Tyrion truly was nonplussed. He drank. Lord Tywin seated himself.
"You have the right of it about Stark. Alive, we might have used Lord Eddard to forge a peace with Winterfell and Riverrun.
A peace that would have given us the time we need to deal with Robert's brothers. Dead? His hand curled into a fist.
Madness. Rank madness.
Joff's only a boy, Tyrion pointed out. At his age, I committed a few follies of my own.
His father gave him a sharp look.
I suppose we ought to be grateful that he is not yet married a whore.
Tyrion sipped at his wine, wondering how Lord Tywin would look if he flung the cup in his face.
Our position is worse than you know, his father went on. It would seem we have a new king.
Sir Kevin looked perplexed.
A new who? What have they done to Joffrey?
The faintest flicker of distaste played across Lord Tywin's thin lips.
Nothing yet. My grandson still sits the Iron Throne, but the eunuch has heard whispers from the south. Renly Baratheon wed Margaery Tyrell at Highgarden this fortnight past, and now he has claimed the crown. The bride's father and brothers have bent the knee and sworn him their swords.
Those are grave tidings. When Sir Kevin frowned, the furrows in his brow grew deep as canyons.
My daughter commands us to ride for King's Landing at once, to defend the Red Keep against King Renly and the Knight of Flowers. His mouth tightened. Commands us, mind you, in the name of the King and Council.
How is King Joffrey taking the news?
Tyrion asked, with a certain black amusement.
Cersei has not seen fit to tell him yet, Lord Tywin said. She fears he might insist on marching against Renly himself.
With what army? Tyrion asked. You don't plan to give him this one, I hope.
He talks of leading the city watch, Lord Tywin said.
If he takes the watch, he'll leave the city undefended, Sir Kevin said. And with Lord Stannis on Dragonstone...
Yes, Lord Tywin looked down at his son. I had thought you were the one made for Muttley, Tyrion, but it would appear that I was wrong.
Why, father, said Tyrion, that almost sounds like praise.
He leaned forward intently.
What of Stannis? He's the elder, not Renly. How does he feel about his brother's claim?
His father frowned.
I felt from the beginning that Stannis was a greater danger than all the others combined. Yet he does nothing. All Varys hears his whispers. Stannis is building ships. Stannis is hiding sellswords. Stannis is bringing a shadowbinder from Ashai. What does it mean? Is any of it true?
He gave an irritated shrug.
Kevin, bring us the map.
Sir Kevin did as he was bid. Lord Tywin unrolled the leather, smoothing it flat.
Jaime has left us in a bad way. Roose Bolton and the remnants of his host are north of us. Our enemies hold the Twins and Moat Cailin. Robb Stark sits to the west, so we cannot retreat to Lannisport and the Rock, unless we choose to give battle. Jaime is taken, and his army for all purposes has ceased to exist. Thoros of Myr and Beric Dondarrion continue to plague our foraging parties. To the east, we have the Aerons. Stannis Baratheon sits on Dragonstone, and in the south, Highgarden and Storm's End are calling their banners.
Tyrion smiled crookedly.
Take heart, father. At least Rhaegar Targaryen is still dead.
I had hoped you might have more to offer us than japes, Tyrion,
Lord Tywin Lannister said. Sir Kevin frowned over the map, forehead creasing.
Robb Stark will have Edmure Tully and the Lords of the Trident with him now. Their combined power may exceed our own, and with Roose Bolton behind us... Tywin, if we remain here, I fear we might be caught between three armies.
I have no intention of remaining here. We must finish our business with young Lord Stark before Renly Baratheon can march from Highgarden. Bolton does not concern me. He's a wary man, and we made him warier on the Green Fork. He will be slow to give pursuit. So,
On the morrow we make for Harrenhal. Kevin, I want Sir Adam's outriders to screen our movements. Give him as many men as he requires, and send them out in groups of four. I will have no vanishings.
As you say, my lord, but why Harrenhal?